Testing 100, 200, 300.
Today is April 23rd, 2005, and I am Pat Davis, and I'm interviewing Mo Ornstein, who was a Peace Corps volunteer in what was Nyasaland, now Malawi, serving in an education project from January 2003 to December 2004. And Mo, why don't you just give us, describe your present family and your work, residence, interest, just where you are now.
Sure. I practiced labor and employment discrimination law after my service in the Peace Corps. I now act as a mediator and arbitrator. I'm married to Grace Manning Orenstein, who was Peace Corps volunteer at the same time I was. In fact, we met in the Peace Corps. We have two children, one who is in finance and lives in London with two children, and a daughter who lives in New York who is a writer. And have I answered your question?
I think so. That's great. I'd like you to think back before you even thought about entering the Peace Corps, and how did you hear about the Peace Corps?
That'll take a little time to explain, but it was very significant. I was at the University of Michigan Law School, and I watched one of the first TV debates between Richard Nixon and John Kennedy. And shortly, well, immediately after the debate, John Kennedy was coming to Detroit to give a speech, I think, before the United Auto Workers the following day. He stopped off in Ann Arbor. Ann Arbor was fairly close to the airport that serviced Ann Arbor and Detroit, and he spoke to the university. Basically, he spoke at the student union, which was right across the street from the law school. So I walked over there. It was about 10 o'clock at night, and Kennedy spoke for about 15 minutes. I was absolutely enthralled by his comments. He didn't have any notes. Nobody was feeding him and telling him what to say, but it was clear his remarks were geared to a well-educated university-type town and to the many idealistic, I suppose, young students who were there, myself included. And in his speech, which was very positive and forward and progressive looking, John Kennedy spoke about how wealthy our country was, how blessed we were, and why he didn't, or he believed that young people of our nation should be able to go overseas and spread some of the riches and wealth of America and the democracy and the economic system and help out those people who weren't as fortunate as us. It was an absolutely beautiful speech, and that is a speech that is now described as the beginning of the Peace Corps, because after his speech, the reporters started asking him, well, what did you mean by that speech, sending young people abroad to serve abroad and to take the take America at its best and to help people overseas? And that actually, it's a famous speech that he gave, and it was the beginning of the Peace Corps, and I'll never forget it. It's like it happened yesterday. And so when the Peace Corps was established after I got out of law school, I had a short military commitment, and when I concluded that, the Peace Corps was up and operating, and I applied, and I guess we were one of the first sets of volunteers, certainly the first to Nyasaland. It was still early in the Peace Corps future, and that's what inspired me to join the Peace Corps.
That's really exciting, and I'd like to know, just personally, since you had finished law school, then how did you connect with an education project?
Well, there weren't legal projects at the time. I hadn't started the actual practice of law. And I wanted to take a couple of years to serve in the Peace Corps. It was something that inspired me. And I thought at the very worst, I'd be put 2 years behind in my legal career or legal development. And over the course of a lifetime, I concluded that 2 years was a very small stretch indeed, and that I was going to do what I could at a time when I was able and didn't have any financial commitments.
That's great. And so you heard about it by the time you finished your military commitment, then it was in full swing and you made the choice.
Peace Corps was up and running, and I applied maybe I think I applied right after my military service because I had used all the deferments I could. When I graduated law school, that was it. I had to go in.
Well, then you're back from the military, and I bet your family thought you were going to open an office, and here you are wanting to go to Africa. What was their response?
When I decided to go to Africa?
Mm-hmm. Or join the Peace Corps instead of opening a law practice?
I think that my parents were kind of proud. I'm sure they were concerned after all the time and effort you spend in going to undergraduate and graduate school. In my case, my parents didn't have a lot of money, and everything they paid for in my college education and law school education, I'm sure they thought, when are we going to get a payback on that, and why aren't you, we've done all this for you, why aren't you starting your practice of law? But I think they recognized that this was something that I really wanted to do, and I never felt any grumbling or griping, and they fully supported me, and I think we're proud that I was doing this. It's something I could do.
Right, that's good. So when you applied to the Peace Corps, were you given an option of what projects you wanted to take, or did they just, you filled out a form, you went to training, and then you were told, or how does the process work?
I think in the application you could put a preference for an area of the world, South America, Africa, and my best recollection is that I did not put a preference, I just wanted to be in the Peace Corps, and when I was selected for the Malawi One, country was then known as Nyasaland Project, I didn't know anything about Nyasaland or where it was in fact. So I had to look it up in the atlas and then do whatever reading I could in an encyclopedia about it.
That was the same with us.
Okay.
When Tom called me from Washington and said we were going to go to Nyasaland, I just say, where is that?
Yes.
So, but that was exciting to be able to learn about a new country and prepare to go. Well, your next step was for training. And can you tell us where you went for training, sort of the location, the place you stayed, how was it organized? And
our training was about a two-month, fairly vigorous training, I suppose, in Syracuse, New York, and we stayed at an ancient old hotel called the Onondaga Hotel, which is no longer there. I don't remember too much about the training. They taught us how to make lesson plans. They taught us a lot about cultural differences. We had an African, actually from Malawi, maybe two of them, who were teaching us the language. I'm not sure they were linguists and were very good at teaching. They certainly knew the language. One of them died in an automobile accident, so that kind of set us back on our training for Chinyanja, which perhaps half of the country spoke. When I got over to Africa, we were sent into an area of the country where they spoke a language or a dialect called Timbuktu, which of course we knew nothing about, and the people who spoke Chinyanja couldn't speak Timbuktu. And it was all a result of the colonists, and when they carved up Africa, they didn't carve it up along tribal lines. They carved it up along the power bases of the European countries who were going into Africa. So Malawi was a typical country, and it was carved up, and there were three basic tribal areas.
Right.
And that became the country.
That's right. Now, your training time was two or three months?
2 months.
2 months.
2 months.
And as far as other trainees with you, I know one became very important to you out of that time. Tell us about that.
That's a none too subtle question, but I got it. I met my wife, actually the first night in Peace Corps training. I remember there was a dinner at the hotel, and I think they had set us up in tables according to our last name, had alphabetized us. My name is Ornstein, her maiden name was Manning. Mm-hmm. So we were at the same table, and she was sitting opposite me. So I met her, and we gradually got to know one another and quickly fell in love and married. Just before we went overseas, we got married the latter part of December 1962, While we were in Syracuse training, I think we were on a Christmas break, and then came back to Syracuse to conclude our training, and were sent over to Africa, to Malawi, first or second week in January of 1963.
That's exciting, starting off your married life in a new country, in a new job, and all the, what they say, the high pressure ones. So I want to come back to that, how that was. But tell me about the other, just working together with 43 or 45 in your group, or because two were deselected?
It was fun, it was exciting. There was a lot of camaraderie. Everybody was interested in learning as much as possible about the new country. Most of us didn't know anything about it. And whatever historical lessons we were given on the country, we just lapped it up. Some people had a background in education, I didn't, but they taught us how to make lesson plans, which I guess to a large extent we used in Africa, but we didn't get specific training on what we would be teaching in Africa. So we learned a little bit about African history, a little bit about African culture, and as best they could tell us, the culture of the country we were going to, Malawi. And they talked to us a lot about the concept, I guess I hadn't heard the words before, cultural shock, and how would we prepare ourselves for cultural shock, because their culture is so different than ours, and it's a third world country, we come from a very wealthy country, etc., etc., etc. So made it sound like it was going to be a terrible transition when we got to Malawi.
Was it for you when you got there?
You know, not at all. I didn't feel any culture shock. It was like being in a state that I had never been in before. The country of Malawi I found to be a small, rewarding country. I didn't find, well, maybe it was there, but in the parts of the country I was sent to, didn't find starvation, which is what I kind of expected. I found people who were had enough to eat. There was a lot of malnourishment and malnutrition, and some of the students and teachers would have little welts and moles on their body, and it was because they weren't getting adequate vitamins and minerals. And their basic food was an ensema, which is a corn product, which they literally ate year-round. If they were wealthy enough, they could throw some fish or vegetables on it, but oftentimes they didn't. So the food they ate wasn't terribly healthy for them, but they were happy people, and it was subsistence agriculture. And when we got there, it was a part of the colonial empire of England. It was called the Federation of the Rhodesias, which included Northern and Southern Rhodesia, and Nyasaland. Nyasaland was the smallest country, and there were about 10,000 British patriots who were there, much smaller than a Northern Rhodesia or Southern Rhodesia, which was their real power base. And because of the small number of English people there, I didn't sense a lot of racial hostility or racial tension between the British and the Malawians.
I want to just think back to your time in Syracuse, and thinking, in hindsight, did your training prepare you? Was it useful? Did you feel equipped? Or just general equipping and when you got to the country?
I think had we had better language training and better language skills, that would have helped a great deal. But one of the sad but true things in Malawi is that as a result of the fact that the British had carved up the country and taken whatever area they could get and fought with the Germans and the French to get their share of Africa, the tribal areas, the three separate tribal languages, and the main language for the country was English, strange as it may sound. So Parliament was addressed in English. The national newspaper, I think the only newspaper they had at the time, the first page was in English so as not to offend anybody. The second page was in the main tribal language, Shinyanja, which is the tribe of about half the people. So when we got to the schools where we taught, We were teaching English as a second language, not English as a foreign language. So I guess one of the sad things is, and I think it's still true today, that English is, if you will, their national language, mm-hmm. which seems kind of strange, but that's the way it is.
And I'd like to ask you about your, some of these we've talked about, your when you arrived in the country, did you know in advance where you're going to be assigned, or was that all a surprise when you got there?
I think it was, we had no idea, I think is the answer, and we had a one-week training course. We landed in the main city in Malawi, which is called Blantyre, and right outside of Blantyre there's a teacher's training school called Soche Hill, or Soche Hill College, and we had some in-country training there. And I think in the course of that training, we were told where we were going, and Grace and I were assigned to a school in northern Malawi with one other volunteer, so there were three of us going up there.
I don't think we've done this, but describe the project, your group project. What were you going to be doing?
It was an educational project, and the country of Malawi, when we got there, had was a country of about 4 million population, and they had, we were told, 31 university graduates. That's all they had. And the reason they couldn't get many more university graduates is because there weren't many secondary schools or secondary school teachers. So our project basically bulked up and maybe even doubled the size of the number of secondary school teachers. And with more secondary school teachers, they were able to bring more students from the primary school into the secondary school that otherwise wouldn't be there. And with more secondary school students graduating, they had the potential, more of them had the potential, as it turned out it was true, to go on to universities in Europe and the United States. So it's a very worthwhile project.
Great. Tell us about the Peace Corps staff.
I can't tell you too much. You were on the staff, of course, mm-hmm. but most of the staff were located in Blantyre, and we were out in the hinterlands. So it's not that we liked the staff, but we didn't see too much about
exactly.
see too much of them. It's certainly on a weekend you'd never go. We could never go down there, and occasionally somebody would pop through where we were located, and maybe when there's a holiday break, Christmas break or something, we would be down in Blantyre and meet up with the staff. So basically, the staff didn't interfere, I think, which is the most important thing. Didn't tell us how to do our jobs. So we were assigned to a school and we were expected to do whatever was required at the school, and that's what we did.
Then what about if you got sick?
Well, if we got sick, I guess we called your husband, but I hope that there wasn't much going on, because the Peace Corps volunteers were young, healthy, and it was a country where there wasn't a lot of illness, and we took pills for malaria. You had to watch out for poisonous snakes, but that's about it.
And I think one of the goals was to, Tom's office was in Blantyre, but the volunteers knew where to go to get some help if they were sick in their particular area.
Had I gotten sick, I think the first thing that would have happened, I picked up the telephone and called Dr. Tom Davis
there
and
you
said,
go.
What do I do?
Exactly. Okay. Now, thank you. I had heard, that's something I had heard about, here we are going to Africa, and there was a little disappointment on the volunteers' part when they arrived and they're going to live in these nice brick houses. But because you were teachers, tell us why you lived in that kind of housing.
That's a good question. When I went to Africa, I expected to live, well, I didn't know what to expect, but I didn't expect much. And I was prepared for the worst. And we lived in two different houses when we were in Africa, and they were very, very comfortable houses, brick houses, with bedrooms and views, and they were just gardens in some cases. They were very nice, and it was better than 99% of the Malawians, and it was a little embarrassing in a sense. And the reason for that is that because they had so few university graduates, those who were university graduates and those who were teaching, it was a prestigious position. So they, it was their cultural thing. So they provided good housing, which we got the benefit of. So it wasn't something we were asking for and would have been quite happy not to have anything as luxurious as what we got.
So you and Grace are newlyweds, assigned to a school up country. And I lived in Blantyre, which was near the, in the south. So tell us about where your school was and the location from Blantyre. And
we were in two different places. One in Zuzu, which is a small town in northern Malawi, and then in a town called Kasungu, which is in the central part. And when I talk about the nice housing, let me describe the second house, which was quite nice. We didn't have electricity. We had kerosene lamps, which after the first day you learn how to operate them, it's fine. We had a refrigerator, and I forget from my old physics how it operates, but it also works on kerosene. You light a little kerosene thing, and the heat is converted to cold. I'm not sure how it's done, but it's done. So we had a refrigerator. We had a wood stove, which sounds like an inconvenience, but once you figure out how to work it, it works quite well. And for water, we had running water in a sense. There was a tank on the top of our house that held exactly 44 gallons of water. There was a tank on the side of the house which held exactly 44 gallons of water, and it had a pump where you could pump the water from the tank up to the top. And we had to hire someone who pushed an oil drum about 100 yards where there was a well, and then he could run the water from the well into the oil drum. Then it was a pretty hard job. He would push the oil drum to our house, and then there was a little tap, and he'd take the water and bucket by bucket and put it in the tank on the side of the house. When that was filled, he or I would use the hand pump, pump it up to the top, and then he'd get another barrel of water and put it on the side. So at most, we had 44 gallons of water on the top of the house, a side or safety tank of 44 gallons on the side of the house, so we had access to 88 gallons of water, which meant that we didn't waste any water.
No long showers.
There were no showers. There were baths in about 1 inch or 2 inches of water, and when you turned on the water to get some tap water or to cook, you only used the water you were going to use. You didn't let the water tap run. So it seemed like an inconvenience, but it was just such a minor thing that was almost
something. You just learned to live with it.
You live with it, you kind of joked and laughed about it.
So tell me, who did the shopping, and who did the cooking, and who did the cleaning, who did the laundry?
Well, in the first place, I guess I did the shopping and Grace did the cooking. She was learning how to cook. And then I gradually helped out more and more. We would both go to the market and the local markets and select, sometimes there'd just be a slab of a cow there, and we'd have to point to the part of the cow that we wanted them to cut and chop for us.
Did you cook with pressure cooker then, with that kind of beef selection?
Sometimes a pressure cooker, well, actually some of it was fairly good. We'd grind it up sometimes and make hamburger meat. We could get a fair selection of fruits and vegetables, so we're okay there. And that was about it. It wasn't any hardship.
So you didn't have anyone that did your laundry for you or that type of thing you hired?
We had to hire someone who washed the clothes on one of those old, I guess, my
parents, yes.
Boards, exactly. And then the clothes had to be hung outside to dry in the hot sun, because that killed the larva that created what was called a putzi fly. And if you didn't do it that way, then it would get under your skin and cause an infection.
So did you do, if you didn't have electricity, you couldn't iron, so?
Well, you could iron.
You could heat the
there were irons, they looked just like irons, and you had to burn some wood and get some charcoal and then put it in there, and that was used as an iron. So the person who worked for us was quite adept at creating a little wood fire, cutting it up and using the coals and putting it in there, and then would iron the clothes.
Well, tell us about your teaching assignment, because now, as I recall, you're a lawyer, you graduated from law school, and now you're teaching a class. What did you teach?
Well, I taught English as a second language, so I could handle that one because English was my primary language and I knew something about it. But I also taught African history, about which I didn't know very much and hadn't been trained. I had just the rudiments of training at Syracuse where we met. So I had to purchase some good books, and at that time there was a Penguin African series put out by Penguin Press, which I think is an English company. They were excellent books. And to say that I was a chapter or two ahead of the students would be pretty accurate, and that's how I did it. But actually, the history books that I got to study and design my lesson plans from were very sophisticated, very detailed, at least based on what the knowledge at that time. And it was a question of me having to cut it down, pare it down, and present it in a reasonable, coherent fashion.
I want to ask you, could the teachers in this first, in this Malawi first group, in teaching their classes, just design their lesson plans the way they wanted to, or were there guidelines from the country?
Well, the first year when we worked at Mzuzu, there was a famous elderly Englishman who was there. His name was Sir Martin Rosevere, who was knighted by the Queen. And he and his wife, Sir Lady Rosevere, ran the school. And they gave us a great deal of freedom. They told us what the course was supposed to cover, so we had a broad outline. But were very good in allowing us to present it in the way we wanted. I guess we spoke to him about how we intended to present it, but I don't remember him creating any impediments. The second year, there was an African Malawian who was in charge of the school, who was subsequently, I'll get into that later, dismissed from the school. And it was pretty much the same. He had a course curriculum that he was supposed to follow that came down from the education minister. And as long as we told him we were following it and basically what we were doing, he gave us broad discretion in how we wanted to present the information.
Did the students all had to take, what's the Cambridge exam, or what exam in order to get to?
Yeah, they had to prepare for the, whatever they call it, the English exams, and I'm not sure it's Cambridge or something. So that's how their system was geared up, and that's what we were teaching.
The main things you had to cover what was in that exam, and any extras that you wanted.
Yeah.
So tell me, what was, this is a typical day, but a typical week. You taught, what hours of the day did you teach?
I also taught, they were into sports, and I was the soccer coach, so I had to learn. I'd never played soccer in my life, but I knew enough about soccer strategy and passing and who was supposed to patrol what lanes. I couldn't demonstrate, never attempted to, because I'd make a fool out of myself, but I knew enough about the theory of the game, or read enough about the theory of the game, that I probably was an acceptable coach, if you will. And then, as I said, African history and English. And it was a fairly full day, probably typical of what an American school day would be, starting, 8:30 or 9 in the morning, going till the middle of the afternoon, with the soccer sports after school's over.
Were you at boarding schools or not?
We were not. At both schools that we worked, the students would come to the schools. I don't recall any of them with bicycles, but some had long treks to make on foot, and they would make it.
Now, we have parent-teacher conferences here. Did you have anything like that?
No. I can't say that I ever met the parents. Occasionally you'd meet one, or occasionally if we go to a village, we would meet some parents. But otherwise, that didn't seem to be a part of their school tradition or school culture.
And tell me, why did you change schools? Was it just a change in assignment?
There was a change in assignment, and there was a dispute with the teaching method or teaching. It's kind of slipped my mind, but it was for the mutual benefit of everybody. I'm not sure why, and I'm not sure Sir Martin Rosier was there anymore. I think that was the problem. His replacement was very rigid in some things and didn't get along with some of the others, so we were transferred out. It wasn't with Sir Martin Rosier.
Okay. And I would like to know, then a teaching week is 5 days, just like we would have.
Yes.
Full days. And what did you do in leisure time, if you had any, by the time you're preparing and coaching sports and a new husband?
Yeah, well, we would take hikes, explore the area. We would read. We had plenty to read. We had Peace Corps books. So there was a fair amount of leisure time. And in the evening, once we lit the lantern, we could read by it, but it seemed like it would be dark, and reading by a kerosene lamp is not the easiest or best thing, so we generally went to bed fairly early and got up fairly early, and that was a day.
How often did you have a break from the teaching?
Well, whenever they had a break, they would have their spring breaks or winter breaks. We usually would travel.
Okay.
Oftentimes outside the country and other parts of Africa.
Tell me some of the places that you traveled. And how did... We just have a couple more questions to ask. And one is, have you continued any kind of involvement or contact with your country of service, with Malawi, or with the people?
Not a lot. Some more after I got out of the Peace Corps volunteer, and we did some work with the Northern California Peace Corps volunteers. In terms of family, I know that our children would view Grace and me as, gee, that's something, you really did something quite good in your life. And it was, they were always complimenting us on it, and we never held it up to them. But I realized, I always thought I knew my children fairly well, and how you influence children directly, you understand. Sometimes indirectly, you don't understand it. I didn't understand. Can we go off? So, I recall once my son served as the executive director, not making much money, for a nonprofit organization, doing a lot of good. And after 2 or 2.5 years of doing this, he went to business school and is now working in an organization that he helped farm. He's an entrepreneur. But I remember after working 2 years in a nonprofit organization, traveling different parts of Africa and South America, his comment was, "This is my Peace Corps."
And how did he mean that?
He meant it in a very positive way. And it was wonderful to hear him say that. And I was proud that we had been a good influence.
That is wonderful to see that. And he didn't have to do it your way.
No.
He could do it in his way and still feel it a very positive. Tell me about your daughter. And has she done something like that? Or just in a different way?
Well, she has too. We traveled to Africa in the early 90s, and as a result of that trip, she majored in art history, and especially African history, and received a grant after graduation from college to study in Haiti, which picked up a lot of African tradition.
Oh, yes.
And she became kind of an expert in Haiti, and was on the UN group that came in when Mr. Aristide was first brought in. She was not one of the soldiers, she was one of the UN peacekeeping. And I think that came probably from our Peace Corps experience too. And she worked for the government of Haiti. But I think her ideas and a lot of it came from what we had done too.
That's really exciting to hear, because you open the world to them, and their choices, then they could choose not just serving people here, but people around the world. And
you said it in a very nice way.
That's exciting. That's really exciting. So this last question about effective view on you and your Peace Corps service, we've talked, you've answered that
I think so.
Wonderfully, because you and your wife both have been involved not only in your careers, but in serving people. Out of and your children serving people, so I think it's, I'll answer this for you, that it's, there was an immediate plus a long-term change in your life that has gone down to your children. It won't be exciting to see grandchildren.
And you said it better than I did.
And how they will be involved in serving man.
Yeah.
So anything else you'd like to add on this?
I think that's it. Thank you.
Okay.